It's time for You and Yours with Peter White and Liz Barclay.
Hello. Today, British Airways decides not to get too heavy on its new controversial baggage charges. Helen Lederer on the fashion industry's size zero row. The couple threatened with court action over someone else's electricity bill. And on call, You and Yours, Peter's got something called affluenza. That's to say, we may be better off as a nation, but are we really happy? Zero row. The couple threatened with court action over someone else's electricity bill.
Having nice dinner with all my friends. £80 billion.
If there was peace in the world and the country stopped fighting. Okay.
Many things. No, I don't want to say it and record it.
We're asking people, what would make you happy?
Money. Chocolate.
Lots of money.
Going out to the pub.
Versions of happiness. Well, in his new book, Affluenza, psychologist Oliver James claims he's discovered that citizens of English-speaking nations are twice as likely to suffer mental illness as those living in mainland Western Europe. But why? Well, he says it's because we're facing an epidemic of affluenza, a disease he defines as a contagious middle-class virus causing depression, anxiety, addiction and ennui. Such an epidemic, he says, is because we place too high a value on money, possessions, appearance and fame. Well, on today's Call You and Yours, you can ask him how he's reached such a conclusion and debate with him if you think he's wrong. He's with us throughout the programme. So, Oliver James, what's the science behind all this? And are we really unhappier than we were, say, 50 years ago?
14 studies done in different nations show that if you place a higher value on money, possessions, appearances, physical and social, and fame, you're more likely to suffer from mental illnesses, not just unhappiness, I mean actual mental illnesses, excuse me, and things like depression, anxiety, personality disorder, addictions. Now, the reason that virus has that effect is because it interferes with us meeting our fundamental human psychological needs, of which psychologists have listed four main ones: for security, for community, feeling part of an intimate group of family and friends, for effectiveness, so many of us don't feel effective in our work and in our lives, and finally for autonomy and authenticity. Now, if you suffer from the affluenza virus, it really does cause you to conflate your needs with wants, the wants that have been confected by advertisers and the media and, in fact, the whole society that we live in.
Is this, though, partly because we do just have more time and more money to indulge in talking about our problems and what's wrong with us?
No, absolutely not. I went in 2004 to seven different nations, spending 3 weeks in each interviewing people. And as soon as I got out of the English-speaking world to Shanghai, Moscow and Copenhagen, I found an extraordinarily different world. I was expecting that we were going to be living in a sort of giant Americanized shopping mall with most of the products in it American, made in China. And to my great pleasure, I found that when I got to China and to Russia and to Copenhagen, it was so different.
And yet China is in the middle of a huge economic boom. So isn't that likely, with your theory, to have exactly the same problem? If not now, then very soon.
Well, it's a very interesting test case of my theory, Shanghai particularly. While I was there, I spoke to the leading psychiatric epidemiologist there, who said that he thought that in 20 years' time, Shanghai would have the same prevalence of mental illness as New York. But at the moment, it has six times less than the Americans. So the Americans, 26.4% of Americans suffered a mental illness in the last 12 months.
So where is the evidence that the drop in mental health here is the result of selfish capitalism, which is what you tie it to? Where's the link? It's quite a political book, this, isn't it? It's not just a psychological theory of yours.
Well, no, it's not a political book. It's actually starting from the WHO, the World Health Organization, International study of the prevalence of mental illness in different countries. And when I got to Denmark, for instance, years, I found that, contrary to what you said earlier, that that people there do not worry so much about money. I interviewed one of the leading newspaper editors there, who's only paid five times more than the taxi driver who took me there. Now, that's not a political point. The point is that the gender roles there and the relative equality of income have meant that those people are not nearly as stricken by affluenza. They really, retailers there, do not find it's worth trying to sell the latest widescreen telly or luxury goods, because the people there just don't want it.
Can we look just quickly at some of your solutions, because you have some? For instance, perhaps the most fundamental one, funding one parent to look after their child full-time.
Yes, I have two serious propositions at the end of my book. One is that one, which is that all under 3-year-olds should have a parent who is paid the national average wage. Now, that is a way of cutting through, because we're so affluenza-stricken, the only way I can see to raise the status of caring for small children, which is so crucial in all this, is to pay them that money. At the moment, the market is infringing, is eating its way into the domestic household economy. The psychology of the home is being destroyed by market economics in the English-speaking world. This is not true in Denmark, it's not true in mainland Western Europe.
You also suggest knocking a knot off all house prices and nationalising estate agents. Serious suggestion?
Yes, I put forward a whole number of suggestions after my serious ones. The other serious one is that we should cap the amount of money that the top earners get. That we should just stop the people being very rich and just give it an end to $1.2 billion in the back pocket of Philip Green as he shoves off to Monaco without paying any tax. End that. But no, the other points I make, they are serious, but obviously the proposals are unlikely to ever come about. So, for example, if you knock a nought off the price of your house, you think, good Lord, I don't want that. But then think that it will actually cost less to buy your new house. And so much of our money and so much of our lives are dominated by mortgages, are dominated by having to work a holier in the English-speaking world is widespread. Again, we work far more hours than they do in mainland Western Europe. And selfish capitalism, as I call it, is the reason why. It's an incredible... just really think about this. Twice as likely that a quarter of us in the last 12 months have suffered from a mental illness in the English-speaking world, but only 11.5% of people have in mainland Western Europe. Now, what on earth is that about? And think how serious that is.
You debate this with Oliver, who's going to be with me throughout our phone-in, if you've got views on this. We want to know what you think. Are we really afflicted by an epidemic, such as affluenza? What's to blame? Or have we never had it so good, and we should ignore what you might be thinking is psychobabble? And I'll also be interested to hear from people who've spent time in countries who either have, in your view, who have not contracted the virus. To take part, all you need to do is call 08700 100 444, or you can email us via the website, or you can text us by typing YOU and your message to 63399. Liz. Sean. Now, on Call You and Yours today, as Liz was saying, we have the psychologist Oliver James to talk about affluenza theory, a virus leading to unhappiness, which he says is caused by a society sick with materialism. He also wants, as some of the solutions to this, to nationalise estate agents, take glamorous-looking people out of adverts, and impose a limit on the number of American shows on our TV screens. What do you think? Is materialism now dominating our lives to a dangerous extent, and if it is in a global economy, is there much we can do about it? Oliver is here, but we'll take your calls first. The number 08700 100 444, and calls cost no more than 32 pence. Let me go to Diane, first of all, in Milton Keynes. Diane, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
What's your take on this?
Well, when I heard what Oliver James was saying, I absolutely sat up in alarm, because I have lived abroad for 13 years. I lived in Cyprus. And I came back here, and I just found this country was so different to the one I left. And Oliver James actually put it together in a nutshell. I think over here we seem to work in order to live. Over here we live in order to work. We get up in the morning to go to work, and work is upper in our mind.
But Diane, we used to be called the sick man of Europe because we didn't work hard enough.
I think that was a fallacy. I think there were things to work out, especially in the 70s. There were wrongs in our society and in our work practice. but we have gone to the absolute opposite extreme, and it's taken a toll in, as Oliver James said, the way that children are brought up, the disintegration of the family, and really, I think there's going to be an absolute total breakdown of society.
When were you in Cyprus, then?
I was in Cyprus from the late 80s to the beginning of this decade.
Is that a significant time scale for your theory, Oliver?
Yes, I mean, you know, it certainly is a great deal worse in the English-speaking world since the late 70s. And as you're saying, Diane, I think it's been a gigantic con. Neoconservatism, as it's called, or what I call selfish capitalism, is really been a huge con. There has been no trickle-down effect. Privatising all utilities, as this programme week in, week out, has to record, the appalling problems that result from that. Everybody says, oh, yes, remember the old BT, etc., but sorry, you know, the privatised utilities have been a disaster, an absolute fraud. And I think you're absolutely right, Diane. I can give you a good example. When I was in New York, I met a 35-year-old man who earns $20 million a year as a stockbroker. He's going to inherit a lot more than that. He used to be a drug addict, and now he's addicted to sex with teenage girls. He lives in a 5-floor, one-bedroom apartment. He is paranoid. He is miserable. He is desperate. He's so lonely. He's a marketing character. He sees himself as a commodity and everyone around him as people, instruments for his pleasure. The next morning, I got into a taxi with a Nigerian who'd been in New York for 2 or 3 years. He couldn't get a green card. He had all sorts of problems, illness, etc. What a lovely man!
But I'll,
and he had, and you know, he like you're saying, Diane, had you know, he'd come from a community. He was still part of the community. There is already a Nigerian community within New York, and he's part of, you know, he's meeting his fundamental psychological needs.
But that's very anecdotal. Are you really telling me that I couldn't find quite quickly, if it suited my case, a very nice billionaire and a pretty nasty, unhappy taxi driver? I'm sure I could.
Of course you could. The scientific basis, what I'm saying, is for studies in 14 different nations, samples in 14 different nations. But my book illustrates those scientific studies.
OK, Diane, thanks for your call. I want to go to Julia Wilton, who's calling us from Bristol. Julia.
Hello. The noise is all from my son, who I'm looking after, and he's not very well.
And which are relevant to what you're going to say, anyway.
Which are very relevant to what I'm going to say. Yeah. What sociologists call highly educated, and have chosen to stay at home and look after my son. Or my husband and I have chosen that's what we'll do as a family. And it's actually quite tough economically. I don't regret doing it, and we're having another child later in the year. And you know, in order to sort of make ends meet and things, I've actually started child money, because I have a background in looking after disabled kids. And I wanted to pick up on Oliver's point about the status of such work, both of staying at home. Hang on a sec. Here we go, this one. And
multitasking, that's what you're doing.
Of staying at home, having had an education, the sort of status drop, if you like, and choosing to child mind for, well, I've pushed the rate up here. The going rate is £3.50 an hour.
But you're saying this is how you're seen, that's seen as a low status job that isn't worth paying a lot of money for.
Absolutely. And at the same time, I totally understand the parents who, you know, are really having to fork out for childcare. There was that study last week, particularly in the southeast, who are really up against it in terms of paying for childcare while both of them choose to work. And a lot of people feel it's no choice at all in terms of paying mortgages and so on. I mean, we live in an area that, you know, we wouldn't necessarily choose to. But it's about the choices we've decided to make about our family.
Julia, we better let you get on with something that's more important even than talking to us.
But on that note, Sue Saunders has emailed to say that she agrees with the absurdity of working all hours to pay for childcare and a modest home. She says she wholeheartedly agrees that without a completely radical rethink, like Oliver James suggests, it'll become the norm.
OK, thank you very much indeed. Can I just put one point very quickly that I'm longing to put to you, Oliver, because there will be those listening to all this who are just saying, oh, this is just a kind of psychologically kind of worked out version of a grumpy old man. And they might also quote to you, you know, when this kind of thing comes up, people just say, well, just think dentistry. In other words, all the things that have actually improved almost cosmically over the last, you know, 50-100 years compared to what people were in the past.
Well, actually, dentistry would be a very poor example as the state of our teeth. Dentistry has been effectively privatised, has declined horribly.
Depends how far back you
But I would like to illustrate Juliet's point. You see, what proportion of under 3-year-olds would you say have a mother who has paid employment? Now, when you ask that question, a lot of people will come up with a much higher percentage than is actually the case. The actual proportion is 55%, and in fact, only 15% of under 3-year-olds have a mother who works full-time. So where do we get that idea from? The media is the representation of motherhood in the media and nouveau riche labour as the whole attitude to it has been a disgrace, has done nothing to raise the status of it above that of a street sweeper. But the proportion is only 15%.
You still got
who actually work full-time under. So I have great respect for Polly Toynbee's work in many ways, but I think it's absolutely disgraceful that she constantly misrepresents, as do Nouveau Labour all the time, none of whom looked after their own children, as though it's the norm. In fact, people are voting with their feet, and most in surveys, as I'm sure you've reported here, time and again, parents will say that they want to spend more time with their under 3-year-olds.
Nonetheless, paying the average wage to one or other of the parents will be very expensive.
And what I should say on that point is, did you realise that 1% of the British landmass is owned by the Ministry of Defence? Now, funny how that hasn't been privatised. How come we spend $30 billion a year on offence? The Ministry of Defence is $30 billion a year, most of which is spent on attacking other nations. And don't get me wrong, I'm not a peacenik. I'm all in favour of us having to kill people if we have to. But for goodness sake, let's have a Ministry of Defence and let's sell off some of that land and pay for it and pay for people to look after their children.
Let's take some more calls. Philip Davis is calling from Perth. Philip, good afternoon.
Hello, Peter. I, broadly speaking, agree with Oliver's view on this, in that the studies do show that happiness isn't going to increase in a straight line with individual wealth and so on. The problem with that, I wanted to sound a cautionary note over, is that we're in danger of marginalising and stigmatising even more a group of people, and they are those people that are clinically depressed, because I think the danger with the argument is that people can look at that group of people and say, you've never had it so good, things have never been, you've never been so wealthy, your material worth is considerable and so on, yet you're still miserable, get on with it. And I just think it's important to realise that, you know, the biological model of depression is something that people have difficulty understanding and getting to grips with.
You don't
and
think,
it's not helped by this.
You don't think Oliver's suggesting, if you like, almost a sociological reason for it rather than a medical reason, which would actually, in some ways, make it respectable? In other words, you're saying society is actually causing it. Why, if the numbers go up, why should that stigmatise it more?
Well, I don't think that I think the danger is that it doesn't recognise that people are suffering from a chronic illness, because it's not evident, because they're not hooked up to a drip and they're not on a life support machine. Nonetheless, and sadly, what happens is it's only recognised as a chronic illness when perhaps people take their lives or some similar self-harm event.
Can I just ask you quite briefly, Oliver, would you acknowledge that danger?
Well, I have sympathy with what you're saying, but I think that the biological model of mental illness is really taking a lot of knocks now. The genetic basis of mental illness is unravelling with the Human Genome Project, although it very much remains to be seen whether genes play much of a role in explaining mental illness. What I would want to ask you, I think, is it Philip? I'd want to ask you, if it is true, the WHO study is true, and if it is true that the English-speaking nations are twice as mentally ill as the mainland Western European ones, that would seem to be very strong, very suggestive that genes do not play much of a role in causing mental illness. And I could quote you endless other evidence, epidemiological evidence of that kind. I'm sure you could quote me other epidemiological evidence back. But the WHO study is definitive, it's the most recent, and they've tried to meet all the criticism. What do you say to that?
I think that we may have a better understanding in the Western English-speaking world than has been developed elsewhere. I think that...
Which may also account for the numbers, mayn't it? That we now have the language and the expertise to give it a name.
I think that's part of it. And Peter, the other thing that I would comment on is that it's not necessarily genetic, but it may still be biological. And, you know, the massive evidence that consultant psychiatrists would quote to you that, you know, if you do the brain chemical tests, you will be able to demonstrate a before and after, if you like, of the effectiveness of antidepressants.
That doesn't tell us anything about cause, of course. But
okay. Can I just come in on there on the issue of mental health problems? Anita Woodruff has emailed to say she's intrigued by Oliver James's ideas. It reminded me of the Buddhist view that our external conditions can never bring us true happiness, but it must come from our internal state. But she says, I was just wondering if these rates could partly be explained by different rates of diagnosis of mental health problems in different countries. So in some places it seems like there are fewer people with mental health problems. Actually, they're just going undiagnosed. Oliver James, have you taken this into account? And just Paul Sutton says, reasons to be miserable. He says, we've heard the anti-capitalist viewpoint. Now let's hear some alternatives that we never hear on the biased BBC. Third world immigration, always opposed by 80% of the population. Multiculturalism was invented to put a positive spin on the fact that the immigrants want to live in their own culture but on our land. They pushed up demand for houses. That demand will be met by destroying the green belt. There are so many of them that they reckon to dictate our foreign policy. Depressed, of course we are. We want our country back.
It's true that the English-speaking world is full of psychobabble and Woody Allen and all the rest of it, and probably influenced by ghastly people like me. But a lot of trouble has gone into this WHO study to try and overcome that problem. And in the case of Shanghai, for example, they are six times less mentally ill. Now, in chapter three of my book, I investigate this in great detail. Mm-hmm. And there's a chap called Arthur Kleinman, who was in the 80s in China, looking at this and seeing whether they really are depressed or whether they just say, when they're depressed, they say they have a physical illness. Now, this is a problem that has been addressed in great detail. And I would, on the second point, what's the alternative? The alternative is unselfish capitalism. I went to Denmark. I saw what they did. There are some things I totally disagree with, like their daycare system. They all get shoved off into daycare at 18 months, which I absolutely abhor, group daycare. But apart from that, in most respects, the Danish are absolutely amazing, and they're very successful economies, which nobody ever talks about.
To go back to Paul Sutton's point, the editor of Politiken, who we talked to yesterday, and I think you talked to, he did acknowledge that in some ways this wish for a homogenised, the fact that Denmark's got quite a homogenised nation, did make them quite xenophobic.
I think there are quite a few things about Denmark that we as Brits wouldn't really like. They are rather sort of indiscriminately friendly. They are pretty homogenous. They don't have a great sense of humour. There are all sorts of things that we Brits are still cracking good at, I can tell you, having gone around the world. We're good at irony. We I love the fact that we don't like being boastful, that you have to be mildly depressed to live in this country, sort of self-disparaging and not saying me, me, me. Thank God, that's still exists in this culture. We're not so Americanized that we've lost that.
Let's take some more calls. Christina is calling from Buckinghamshire. Christina, good afternoon.
Hello.
Yeah, what was your point?
Okay.
If you can remember, you've been on there a long time, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I have. I'm on a mobile. Can you hear me?
Yeah, please? You're fine. Go on.
Okay, can I just very quickly go back to a point that your previous caller was talking about, which is the medicalisation of depression? Because I think that's really something that we're seeing an increasing number of, including in young children. And the medical model is deeply entrenched in our culture, and that started, I believe, with the advent of antidepressants about 50 years ago. And I think it's important to understand that antidepressants have a very useful role to play when people are very severely depressed, because depressed people are in a state of high arousal, and the biochemistry of that actually affects the emotional brain, overstimulates it, and in that condition we're not able to think clearly. We're in an inward focused trance state. So there is a lot of good scientific evidence and a completely rational explanation of how distress can lead to depression and anxiety, and we're seeing more of it in children as well.
So you're saying the two things actually link. You can have sociological reasons that can have physiological effects.
Of course, yes. Of course, I mean, if you want to call it stress and anxiety, all of those things cause a rise in our emotions, which is reflected by caused by our body's biochemistry, which affects how clearly we're able to think and make decisions. It's an inward-focused trance state. And, of course, the drug companies have made a great deal of money out of it, and it's been taken up by medical staff because, you know, they're very scientific and rational in their thinking.
You're bang on the nail there, Christine. Absolutely right. There's a wonderful book by David Healy called The Antidepressant Era, and there's another book by John Reed called Models of Madness. Both those books beautifully describe the way in which the psychosocial, your family background, your childhood history, and your current psychosocial circumstances affect your actual brain. So, for example, a woman who was sexually abused when she was young, on average, has 5% less of the hippocampal region of the brain, and also smaller amygdala part of the brain. And women who are stressed during the last trimester, the last 3 months of pregnancy, when their children are measured 9 years later, their children are still more likely to be hyperactive, aggressive and messed up in all sorts of ways. So there's no doubt at all that the psychosocial affects the physical and is translated into electrochemistry in our brains and actually the different sizes of parts of our brains.
I want to go to one of the issues that Oliver raised as a possible solution to this. He did say it was not the most serious that he came up with, but it was the idea of nationalising estate agents. Chris Wood is from the National Association of Estate Agents. Chris, what do you think about that?
I can't see quite how it'll help anything. From my experience and memory of nationalised industries, they didn't perform particularly well. But if I could just take something on a personal issue first, it's something that me and probably a lot of other dads take probably deep offence at, is whenever we talk about childcare, and I'd like to come back to the estate agency a bit because that's what you got me on for, but whenever we talk about childcare, it's always mums. I know certainly I and a lot of other dads have made big adjustments in their life to look after their children for various different personal circumstances.
I mean, Oliver has made quite a point of saying it's either parent. I think that was the
And also, Chris, I absolutely agree with you, and one of the main arguments of my book is that the situation I'd like to see is one in which parents, on the whole, look after their children when they're small, and that they divide the care between them if they wish to. And that would require flexible working, and it would require the status of being a parent to be much higher. But again, onto the estate agent, the nationalised estate agent, my point is that in all the high streets you have 5-6 buildings taken up with estate agents. Imagine a world, you know, just imagine this, in which you could have videoed houses all around the country, have to be videoed according to strict specifications, and there's a national website, and if you want to move to Dorset or you want to move to Scunthorpe, all you have to do is tune in on the net, you can see where it is, and you take out the 2-3%, which I'm sorry to say, Chris, pays your BMW.
Well, have you got a BMW, Chris?
But I don't.
Let's get...
But in fact, you're very far off. You know, there is effectively that system there already. There is there are two, three major portals in the UK where effectively you can do that. But people, 96% or 95% of people choose to use an estate agent. It's actually very easy to sell your property yourself, but the reason people choose to use an estate agent is because of the added value and the increased security, the increased value of the property, all the hassle of negotiating. Us Brits don't like negotiating.
And then the increased cost of the new house you're buying, and then the increased mortgage, and then we are slow. slaves in the English-speaking world to our mortgages. Property runs the whole thing.
Final word on this, Chris.
I was going to say, the vast majority of moving home goes to Mr. Gordon Brown. You look at the cost of stamp duty, all the other costs and taxes that go in there. Our charges are minuscule compared to somebody buying a large house now.
Don't get him started again on New Labour. I haven't got time at the moment. Liz.
Privatisation of estate agent support. A few ideas, a few solutions. Mike Crawshaw says we should slow down and enjoy life a bit more before it's over. Charlie Lyson says Mary Poppins had an effective inoculation against influenza. Enough, she said, is as good as a feast. More of us should try it. And Roland Cavella from Farnham in Surrey says if we're tempted to climb higher up the ladder in life, we should stop for a minute, look around and ask, do we really need to climb any further? He concludes, you will find that people you meet will start commenting on how happy you seem. And Tony just wants to take Oliver up on one comment. He says, I was doing all right with Oliver, but his comment about selling off MOD land to pay for the under threes parents to stay at home, who'd buy it? Does he know where the land is? Apart from most of it isn't sellable, it's mostly in the middle of nowhere with a planning blight on it. I am a long time out of the forces, but I think we should be thanking the MOD for keeping parts of our land out of the hands of developers, which will fuel.
Salisbury Plains worth a few bob, isn't it?
All right. I want to get to Adrian Murray in London. Adrian, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'd just reverting to the issue of abroad and the difference between abroad and England. I can't help feeling that Oliver may not have been to France or Italy recently when he started talking about our being obsessed with image and wealth and status. I mean, nobody is more obsessed with image and appearance than Italians are, in my experience. And
a lot of fashion companies.
Wealth and status is concerned, the French are totally obsessed by that. I mean, our problem here is we're lumbered with a lot of the work time is taken up with dealing with the bureaucratic consequences of our institutionalized political correctness. It's not a, and that's a huge source of the problem, and one that, that really should be more addressed. I mean, if we're going to restrict things and institutionalized prohibiting of things, I would suggest that we cut down on the release of health scare and psychological scare material without looking at the realities that underline all of this.
Good comment, Oliver.
Well, leaving it to the market hugely inhibits us too. You know, this idea that privatised is better than public is actually just simply not true. A lot of the time, when you actually look at the scientific evidence, our utilities were flogged off at rock bottom prices, particularly the housing. Even today, we're hearing about housing associations, wretched nouveau riche Labour are going to try and flog off the housing associations' properties. It's a disgrace. Actually, they'll flog it off at much too low a price, and we, the taxpayer, have paid for that housing. So I don't like it at all. And as for the people in Italy and France, I think you may have misunderstood. The women there, for example, like the women in Moscow that I interviewed, are actually very different from the English-speaking women. They're not Sex and the City women who are trying to be attractive with a view to getting men to want to sleep with them and other women to envy them. What they're interested in is beauty in Italy and France, and boy does it show, and in Moscow too. And the concept of beauty consists of they are only interested in pleasing the person they see in the mirror.
Oliver James, thank you very much indeed. That is all the time we got for, but thank you very much for all your calls. And can I just remind people that next week on Call You and Yours, we have David Cameron, the leader of the Conservative Party, and you can ask him, well, just about anything you like. I'll tell you more about that next week.
Well, that's it for today. Tomorrow